Rick Fried, MD, PhD, a dermatologist and clinical psychologist. Title is clinical director, Yardley Dermatology Associates, Yardley PA.
Let's talk about your article, Kindling Midlife Fires, and also a little bit about midlife in general. You use it's such an interesting metaphor of fire to describe what can go wrong and what can go right, really, in midlife.
From many of our earliest memories, we've been indoctrinated with an idea that as we age, the vibrancy, the excitement, the fire, the passion all begin to dwindle. And what I've seen professionally in the past 20 years is that, in fact, for most people, midlife is a very passionate, very exciting, wonderful time that's often freer than earlier youth.
And it's really a state of mind, isn't it? I mean, if you can look positively at your life, that's half the battle.
I can't agree more. Attribution. When you're 22 years old playing tennis, you twist your ankle, you say, gee, I must have stepped incorrectly. When you're 42 years old and twist your ankle, you say, oh, gosh, I'm 42. And when we start having those kind of attributions or incorporating some of the early ideas of, gosh, you hit 40, you start spinning the train, it's all downhill. And it is so much attribution and attitude. And we know that the way in which we speak to ourselves, the way in which we interpret our life, drastically can change our physiology in wonderful ways.
I was just interviewing Joe Theismann a few weeks ago, and he was saying to me, and he said it a number of times, but he said it with such oomph. He said, you know, Pat, 60 is the new 40.
In so many ways, physiologically, yes, because we're exercising more, eat better, take better care of ourselves. But again, just as importantly, it's that entire concept of how we interpret our world. You know, if you look at the package insert on Cialis, which many of us know is an erectile dysfunction medicine, the package insert says that 39% of men who take the placebo get the identical response as the active medicine. So expectation dramatically affects physiology. And that is so much of what we're talking about here. Midlife, finding things that interest us, finding things that excite us, recognizing that midlife is the beginning of perhaps chapter 7 of a book of 40 chapters. So each new day offers us opportunities to find new ways to stimulate our interest, to stimulate our bodies, our minds, and it really becomes a fuller, more meaningful existence.
Well, although, you know, having said that, the recession can certainly challenge some of our ideas about what's going to happen to us in middle life. And I see so many people who are in middle age, they can feel obsolete, especially with technology on the march. But you know what? It's on the march for everybody if you're 20 or if you're 60.
One of the things recession, I believe, has done is given us a splash of cold water reality that says perhaps we will need to work longer and into our later years. And that can be a very negative factor, or it can be a very motivating factor that says I've got to take better care of myself. I've got to keep up with what's new and changing. Feeling engaged, feeling needed and useful are some of the ingredients that keep people healthier and living longer. So perhaps at 69 or 74, going to the golf course each day but having no place you must be is not necessarily the best thing for us.
That's a good way to look at it. When you talk about fire also, since you are a dermatologist, you talk about inflammation in the body, which often increases as a person ages. A dermatologist can keep or help keep inflammation under control, right?
Absolutely. If you look at the common thread of so many of the maladies that diminish the quality and quantity of people's lives, whether it is heart disease, whether it's inflammatory bowel disease, inflammatory skin disease, the fire of inflammation is the one that we do want to keep quiet. Use of topical antioxidants, use of topical retinoids, use of sun protection, all these things can diminish the erosive or destructive fires in the skin, while at the same time, we can focus on kindling the productive fires that give us heat, passion, interest, and energy. So it's a matter of keeping the appropriate flames going and diminishing or extinguishing the inappropriate ones internally.
You know, the funny thing is a lot of people are talking about skin tags. They're such a pain in the wherever.
Wherever. Yes, yes. Skin tags are things that we are genetically predisposed to. In areas of friction, be they under the arms, between the legs, under the belly, they are benign little tags of skin that stick out. They can become very irritated. They're very simply gotten rid of either by making them cold with some liquid nitrogen cold spray. We snip them. Skin tags have two main roles. Number one is to be annoying physically, but also sometimes they're emotionally annoying. They're reminders that, gee, you know, mom or grandma or grandpa had lots of these. Does that mean I'm getting older? And I'm a tremendous fan of getting rid of these little reminders of passage of time that don't have to be in our faces all the time. So again, you know, part of maintaining youthfulness is getting a good pair of glasses, literally or figuratively, that have us focus on the positives. In Kindling Midlife Fires and elsewhere, I sometimes talk about the triangle of intimacy. Triangle of intimacy begins at the base of the triangle at the mouth and expands to the top of the triangle at the eyes. So moving from the eyes to the mouth, what those eyes say, what those lips say, that really conveys our energy, our health, our wellness, our passions. So, you know, choosing to focus on those things. The eyes don't change. Choosing to focus on the positive aspects of our physiology, the positive aspects of our bodies. These are the things that can keep us young and at 92, still be looking for the next exciting moment of the day.
Let's talk about Botox. We used to think that it was just something actresses did to try to keep the aging process at bay, but that certainly is no longer the case, and focusing on looking good has such a positive ripple effect for the rest of your life.
Botox is a fascinating, fascinating molecule, and what it does to us and for us is fascinating as well. 10.4 million people in 2008 had Botox, up 5% from the year before. And despite the economy, it's continuing to grow. What Botox is a purified protein that prevents muscles from tightening or contracting. Now, in its simplest sense, when we use Botox and the forehead no longer gets that crinkled, stern, harsh look, we don't look angry, we don't look stressed, we don't look distressed, and we're much more palatable. People want to move toward us. People find us pleasant to be around. So from the messages we give to others, that's number one with Botox. The second thing with Botox is we internally register that tension in our forehead. When we walk into a stressful situation, be it work, be it home, be it competition otherwise, when we tighten that forehead, the brain says, gosh, those muscles are tight. This must be a very stressful, difficult situation, and the brain responds in kind by releasing its stress hormones. And we tend to feel more stressed, more distressed, more anxious. After Botox, we walk into that very same situation. The forehead muscles don't contract. The message to the brain is relaxed situation. Brain responds in kind, releases its relaxation hormones, and often internally, we feel more relaxed, less stress, less distress. The reality is it's not the rich and famous who get the majority of the Botox. The majority of people who get Botox are people between 35 and 65 years of age. Average income between $30,000 and $80,000 a year.
Really? I'm surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So they're certainly not the poor people, but by no means are they the top rich people. And functionally, we did a study in the center that was just published very recently, last month in the Journal of Clinical and Aesthetic Dermatology, and it's fascinating what the study showed. 83% of people, 1 month after Botox treatment, felt more attractive, 59% more confident, 50% less stressed, 49% happier, 49% more optimistic, 36% more relaxed. So it's not just looking handsome or pretty. It's actually changing the way we feel and experience our world. And if we take that a step forward and say, gosh, if we're taking this more optimistic, confident person into the workplace, into that interview, into the bedroom. The implications are terrific.
There's no question about that. Is there anything to the worry that in the hands of somebody who doesn't know what he or she is doing, that you could end up looking like Joan Rivers?
There certainly is an art and a skill to the appropriate placement of Botox and using the correct amounts. So am I fearful that you can cause really dangerous systemic reactions where people could become ill? No. Can you end up looking overly frozen without any movement, mannequin or Parkinsonian-like? Yes, you can. And a couple of years ago in Hollywood, the trend was to ice or stone or freeze the whole forehead. And what they found is people couldn't get parts at auditions. So the appropriate use of Botox is to give that natural, relaxed look without looking artificially too devoid of movement in the forehead.
In the healthcare debate, Doctor, where does Botox and dermatology fit in? And talk about the Botox.
Wonderful, wonderful question. In the healthcare debate, do I believe that Botox will ever be considered a mandatory, necessary, basic healthcare service? No. So in the healthcare debate, I think what Botox does is does give a recognition that beyond getting our immunizations and beyond getting our routine screenings, be they mammograms or the PSA for the prostate, there are other aspects of medical-cosmetic interventions that can, in fact, be important. And if not covered, at least recognized. Now, the Botox, putting a tax on cosmetic procedures, is that a legitimate and fair way to generate more revenue? Well, there's two ways to look at it. I think one can say, if I am fortunate enough and work hard enough to afford this cosmetic procedure, then gosh, I should be somebody who can contribute a little bit more to society. The negative interpretation, though, is if it is in fact the case, which it appears to be, that Botox really isn't just cosmetic fluff, that it really is a meaningful intervention that can change the way we feel and function, then the Botox can, for many people, perhaps make it unattainable or unaffordable. So you can make a case that it's a bit discriminatory. So I think it's a powerful argument on both sides, and it certainly is going to be interesting to the way it plays out because I think it's the tip of the iceberg. What do we do next in terms of taxing the populace for, be they indulgence or personal enhancement? Should we tax people for psychotherapy who are looking for growth and enhancement? Should we tax marital therapy? So I think the implications are many.
In keeping with the discussion of fire, as we were earlier, keep the home fires burning, I think one of the most interesting things about the article was when you talked about how our idea of how a marriage should be has been romanticized, and that often leads to trouble down the road.
I recall vividly in graduate school one of a wonderful supervisor saying that happy marriage is composed of two things, 50% who you marry, the other 50% who you are. And I think it is a daily choice on what we choose to focus on in our partner. Once we begin to focus on the negative, and even worse than that, associate with people who are focusing on the negatives in their partners, the negatives grow and grow and grow until all we see are the imperfections and the entire quantity or entity becomes ugly. In contrast, if we take that same energy and choose to focus on the positive and foster and nurture that, then the entity becomes more attractive, becomes prettier, becomes handsomer. So am I talking about twisting our perceptions of reality? In its purest sense, yes, because every one of us have our ugly sides. Every one of us have our list of imperfections. You know, what we see socially with people is never what you get when you go home with them. What we see on the screen is never what is reality. So, you know, many cultures have very different ideas of marriage than we do. And the Indian culture traditionally says you have an arranged marriage, and your job is to make the best of that. Your job is to find the best in that person. I frankly think that's what all of us should embrace when we enter into a relationship. Are some things beyond our control? Yes. Are some things just too heinous or too ugly that we have to move on? In a percentage of situations, certainly. But for the majority of us, it's two imperfect people coming together who really, in the best of worlds, will find the best in one another, accentuate the positives, share what we can, and pursue our passions on the outside of those that we can't. When I say our passions, I don't mean infidelities. One of the things I frequently would say to people in marital therapy is I think having an affair is a wonderful thing, as long as it's not with another person. I think getting a camera and getting passionately involved in photography, taking up a new sport, taking up a new interest of any kind, we need these excitements and, you know, the midlife fires. So much of that is finding something that turns us on. A new book, a new author, a new skill. I mean, the list is endless. So that idea that we're trapped in this little room of monotony is a myth. For many people, walking to the garden, looking at a new flower, a new vegetable, for others, just rummaging through an antique store. I mean, there are so many ways we can become passionately turned on. And then we can come home, and we can share some of that passion, and then we can keep some of that passion. We can live in our parallel worlds. And life is just a wonderful place. It becomes a difficult and horrible place when we buy into the delusion that every moment has to be filled with excitement as it is dictated to us by Hollywood.
I love your use of John Mellencamp's song. I've often thought of that song and thought, God,
right.
Let me put myself out of my misery now.
But, you know, that again is one of those mantras that we indoctrinate. Life goes on, you know, long after the thrill of living is gone. I see 90-year-olds all the time in my practice who are more passionate about getting up every day than 25-year-olds. So life goes on and is as passionate and exciting as we choose to make it. And I think one thing that is important to a caveat here is that some of the loss of passion in midlife that a percentage of people experience may be subclinical depression. We usually think of depression in terms of the classic, I'm not sleeping, I'm not eating, I feel sad, I have no energy, I'm thinking of hurting myself. That is a minority of people with depression. The majority of depression is subclinical depression. And subclinical depression means I can go to work and function, I can go to parties and smile, tell jokes, respond appropriately, but there's a shine that seems to have faded. Flowers don't smell quite as good. Food doesn't taste quite as good. Sex doesn't feel quite as good or interest me as much or at all. It's a low-level blah. And often that is depression. And that can be treated with anything from cognitive behavioral psychotherapy to low-dose antidepressant medications. And suddenly that low-level blah that we blamed on being 45, 55, 65 has nothing to do with age. It was, in fact, unrecognized depression. So beyond all the other things we're talking about that we have control over in terms of embracing new people, places, and things, I think sometimes it's important to ask yourself, am I feeling blah because of depression? Could it be underactive thyroid? Could it be other vitamin deficiency? So as part of the search for the passions in midlife, I think entertaining this question with the primary care physician or other knowledgeable person can be very helpful.
Very well said. Could you give me some web information?
Absolutely. I mean, you can access some of the articles at yardleyderm.com. dermatologic information, American Academy of Dermatology, AAD.org. In terms of other websites, the American Psychological, American Psychiatric Association, APA.org, have information on depression. And just in general, other web information. One of the things that I love about Google, one of the ways I think that we can help to stimulate our passions, is just sit down, close your eyes, and say, what are some of the things that I'm curious about? And if it's sewing, as you know, you just type in sewing to Google, and suddenly a whole world of passionate interest opens up.
5 hours later.
5 hours later, exactly. So, you know, websites in general, I just think, you know, fantasizing on a keyboard, it's amazing the things you stumble upon and the new areas they find that become a consuming and wonderful passion and entree to new emotions, new people.